Take your Bibles, please, and turn to Genesis. We're in the last couple of verses of Genesis 8. And I know those of you who are obsessive compulsive, you're going to say, didn't you cover the last part of chapter 8 last week? Well, I did, but I told you last week that it's kind of in this next section. You know, when we think about systems of sanctification, there are as many systems out there as there are systems of justification. What do you have to do to get to heaven? There are as many systems out there for that as there are for what a person has to do that which is pleasing to the Lord. We call that sanctification. Probably misnamed, because sanctify in New Testament Greek is always in the aorist tense, have been sanctified. It's never present. It's never a progressive sanctification, which is a major, major theme of American Christianity. There are two exceptions to that, and that's in Hebrews, and there in that context, he's talking about millennial issues, the sanctification that is now sanctifying us. Otherwise, it's a completed sense that by God's grace, we are declared righteous. By God's grace, we walk by faith and continue to receive imputed righteousness. And the reality is, you're as much a rascal now as you ever were. You are just like Paul, the apostle, who said in chapter 7, in my flesh dwells no good thing. O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? Romans 8, where we think that it's a major change. Those who are in the flesh cannot please God. You leave God out of the equation, and I promise you, you are as sinful as you ever were. At this point, you ought to say amen. Because what this gives you is real freedom. It gives you a real understanding of yourself and your relationship to God. It's all of God's grace. But there was a theory of sanctification that was called monasticism. And it believed that if you separate yourself from the world, then you will be less sinful. And when you come out, you will be more holy. And back in the 70s and 80s, there was an author, his name was David Morrell, I think that's his name. You might know him from the Rambo series. He did another series that started the first book, was the Brotherhood of the Rose. And it actually became an NBC series. There were three books that were written in that. And I came across him because I picked up a $1 hardback copy of the Brotherhood of the Rose. And I've lost it. I don't know what happened to it. It's too bad now. It'd be worth about $35. I paid, you know, a dollar for it, hardback copy. But in that book, it starts, it's this story about two brothers, and one of whom begins his life in a monastery. The story starts with him in a monastery. He's an assassin, and he's there to atone for his sins. And, you know, Morrell's a great writer, just a great writer. Keeps you on the edge of the page. Oh no, what's going to happen next? But he does a really good job of describing monasticism. And about the same time, I went down to a meeting down in Austin, and it was being held at the diocese down there, school meeting. And they had a picture. I actually took pictures of it. I've shown it to Marvin. But it was it's a statue, a bronze statue of a little, small, emaciated, crumpled human being. And he's all down like this. And in essence, it is a doctrine that you keep emptying yourself and emptying yourself and emptying yourself and have less and less and less and less until you're down to living on a few crumbs. And of course, that's where the story starts, because he's sharing his crumbs with a mouse that ends up dying, and the whole monastery has been poisoned. So, you know, I want to tell you the story. Go read the book. But the idea of monasticism really is where I want to start. Because if you look at chapter 8, verse 21, you're going to see a very interesting concept here. See, I'm in chapter 8, verse 21. I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. You see that phrase, man's heart is evil from his youth. All right, well, take a look at chapter 6, verse 5. That every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. All right, you see that in chapter 6, verse 5? So your thought is, well, God destroyed the earth and killed everybody on it and all the animals because his heart is continually evil all the time. Well, okay, so you have the flood, and that after the flood, God says, I'm not going to do this ever again. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Nothing changed. And you'll see that as we get into the end of chapter 9. You can save the world population with 8 people and the animals in the ark, but it doesn't solve the problem of sin. We're still back to the same basic structure of human life and constantly evil. So my question today in this sermon title, Never Again, in chapter 8, 22 through 9, 17, is why does God not want to ever destroy the world again with a flood? Why doesn't God destroy all flesh again? He did it the first time, and we think, well, because man's heart is evil all the time, about every thought. Well, nothing's changed. So why doesn't God want to destroy the world again? And I think what we have in chapter 8 and chapter 9 are reasons why God doesn't need to ever destroy the world again. He doesn't need to do this ever again. Now, when we studied Genesis 6, we spent some time and went and looked at the sons of God, and nothing is said about that at this part of the narrative. That's done with. Noah was pure in all his lineage, so that problem is solved. Well, what about the demons that cohabited with women? Well, they're locked up. They're in a place called Tartarus and waiting judgment. So that's off the table. That's not going to happen again. In the same way that it happened before the flood. But then the issue about what about humans? And I think and we're going to see several reasons why God does not need to destroy the human race again with water. And the first is actually in chapter 8, verse 22. Life is going to be a lot harder. While earth remains, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. So it seems to me prior to this, you did not have the seasons. Now some places they have 4 seasons, some places they have 5. Arizona, we had basically 1 season. Everything was dead all the time, except for sometimes in the spring we'd get rain and then the desert would bloom and we'd all go out and look at the flowers and, you know, that was very rare. But this life is a lot harder. Prior to this time, there was a constant temperature. Now, I'll just ask you a question. How hard is this whole thing about time change on you? Is this an easy thing to go through, or is it a hard thing to go through? I just can't understand why this makes no sense to me with my Arizona worldview. Arizona does not have time change. Who wants more daylight when you live in a desert? No brainer. But I find the time change really hard. You know, and you do too. Life is harder. So that the terrarium environment prior to the flood, with the waters above and the waters below and the temperate climate, and anything you wanted to, you could eat all the green plants. You could eat all of them. They were good for you. So it wasn't like you had to work hard to have a long life. It was just a different environment. So all the green plants were given for food prior to the flood. But now he says, you're going to have to plant and you're going to have to harvest. You know, at least those periods of time are incredibly busy. I used to travel as an evangelist, and I had to time my evangelistic services so that the harvest was done in the fall and the planting for the winter wheat hadn't started yet, because that's the only time people had any spare times. And yeah, it was last spring we did the same thing, timed it, and sometimes we'd have snowstorms and they'd drive their tractors to the meetings. It was a lot of fun. But the cold and the heat, you know, how do you handle that? You know, we went to Sabine Creek Ranch the week before last, and on Tuesday when we headed out there, we had a wind that was unbelievable. In fact, Marvin's driving the big bus, you know, he couldn't get it over 40. The wind was just right in our faces the whole way. I was driving the little bus. I could hardly keep it on. The wind blew, and it was cold. We were all wearing coats, and then all of a sudden it's 80 degrees, you know, and all our kids are running around wanting to go swimming in the lake. Well, guess what? They went swimming. Guess what? They all got sick, and they were gracious enough to share their illnesses with each other and with us. So I think when you look at verse 22, it's a statement from God that life is going to be harder. It's going to be harder, which is going to shorten the lifespan. And it actually did. People were living 600 to 900 years prior to the flood. And after the flood, it you know, there were a few generations where it was 120, but, you know, pretty much went straight down to what it is today. I think probably at this time, the Earth's axis was shifted. My guess is that 150 days into the flood, when it says in the chapter 8 that God sent a wind, you know, there probably was rain of some sort before the flood, but apparently this is something new. And when the wind started, then the waters begin to abate. So what, you know, what causes the wind to do that? Well, if you shift the Earth's axis, that accounts for the, you know, what happened to all the water? Well, you know, we got a lot of water stored at the polar ice caps for sure. You know, possibly this accounts for how we come across woolly mammoths with vegetation in their mouth frozen solid as if they're in a deep freeze. That wouldn't have happened over a period of time. So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." These are commands that he gives to them. And we, even though life is harder and life is shorter, God still wants a fully populated planet. It's my belief at this point, it's still a single continent. We'll see in chapter 10 when that divided, when the earth divided. But it's certainly able to sustain all of the humans that can possibly be populated within that one region. Fill the earth. Now the next thing that he says here, in spite of the changes, he wants people to multiply. That's verse 1. In verse 2, he's now going to put the fear of animals, fear of man in animals. "And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the air and on all that moves on the earth and all the fish of the sea. They're given into your hand." So the animals are going to naturally be terrified of the human being. So like verse 22, verse 2, I understand this is something that's new. So with the fall of man in Genesis 3, the full implications of the curse aren't realized until you get past the flood time. So prior to that, the animals apparently had a different relationship, one, because they weren't food, but they had a different relationship with the humans. But now every living thing that moves will be afraid of you. It's all the birds, all the animals, they're going to hate you. They're going to have the dread of man as part of how they view humans. So there's a natural aversion to humans, and based on verse 6, there's also now aggression on the animals. The animals are going to try and kill you. Charlie, when we travel together to God-forsaken parts of the world, he said numbers of times, there's always something that's trying to kill you. That's the world in which we live. We go to Grace Acres, and we hired a fellow to come and put a property boundary in for us because we weren't sure of the property line surveyor. And we wanted to be with him because we wanted to see where the property line was. And, we're getting ready to go out into the forest of Grace Acres. And he goes into the back of his truck and he opens up his truck and he takes out a gun belt and a revolver and puts it around his waist and got a couple of clips. And he's like, oh. He says, oh, no, I don't ever go into the forest unarmed. He said, I made that mistake one time and a wild boar treed me and I was up in the tree for an hour before it gave up. So I don't ever go. But there's always something that wants to kill you. They're terrified of you and they want to kill you. There's domesticated animals, obviously. They're domesticated. They've learned that it's better for them to make friends with you than to not. But I don't know how long it would take before they wouldn't survive in the wild. Those little dogs that we love that take such a nice spot in our heart, you put them out in the wild and they become food for the coyotes. Cats, on the other hand, they do just fine. Feral cats are everywhere. And verse 3 and 4, you have a change in diet. Look at verse 3. Every moving thing that lives will be food for you. I've given you all things, even as the green plants. So prior to this, humans could eat all the green plants. Now he says you also can eat any of the food, living things. Every moving thing that lives will be food for you. Anybody know what a pangolin is? A couple of you. We were in Ghana, and we were heading up to Abatifi, way up past the rainforest, long drive, and we were tooling right along, forest on either side, and we drive by a guy and he's holding something, and we drove by it, and all of us in the Americans in the car, we all said, "What's that?" And our driver turned around and went back, so we did a U-turn and went all the way back. In Ghana, everybody speaks English, well, sort of. And so we go over there, and he's holding a pangolin. We had to get back to the States to figure out what it is. It has a prehensile tail. It's got scales on it, but they're formed like an armadillo. It's scales on it. It looks like a giant lizard, but it's not. It's got four distinguishable feet, and it looks kind of like it moves sort of like a sloth because its eyes are looking up at us. And we said, "What is that?" And the Ghanaian young man, he thinks and he's looking for the English word, and he finally figures out the English word, and he says, "Food." Oh, yeah, great. So, this is his lunch. It's going to be food. And then we got back, we'll look up pangolin. That's That's the animal. I've never seen one like that. It's an African animal. It lives in the forest. But the thing that I'd never seen an animal like that. Two, it was captured. And three, you could see in the eyes of the animal. He's looking around. This animal is terrified. Well, it's terrified because it's going to become food. So why did God put animals as food? And by the way, the Spirit expressly says in the latter times, there will be false teachers who prohibit marrying and giving in marriage and prohibit the eating of meat. And I think we've seen a little foretaste of the marrying and giving in marriage from Biden's directives, where we've had, even to this day, insane gender dysphoria. I mean, the directions we were headed under that administration were appalling and devastating to young people who believe those lies. And I'm glad to report that now they're on the other side of these gender-altering surgeries and medications, and they're starting to sue the idiots that said this was a good idea. That's great. More lawsuits, the better, because they should never have done it in the first place. It should be criminal. Because God made men and God made women. And those genders need to be maintained and kept distinct. In spite of what the culture says. So we became illegal as a corporation the first week of Biden's administration. But I think when you look at the end times, the Spirit expressly says they're going to prohibit the eating of meat. Now, that's been around for a long time. And, you know, you have the worldview that we shouldn't eat our friends. And the worldview that says that kind of thing is really evolutionary. It's coming out of a worldview that humans are on the same plane as animals. So we shouldn't eat our friends because they're on the same. You might be eating your cousin. So the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times, prohibiting eating of meat is something we're going to have to deal with. Here you have the absolute antithesis of that, that every animal is given to you for food. So with the new climate, with the new seed time, harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, you better not make your only diet rice or plants, because it will have a detrimental effect on your health. And, you know, you want me to argue that? I can't. I don't want to take the time to try to figure that out. I'll just teach what it says. So in this new environment, animals are going to become a staple aspect of what people eat. And also, there'll be the plants, but you're going to have to plant them, seed time and harvest. You can't go out anymore and gather a nice handful of oleander leaves and have it for breakfast, because it'll kill you. Okay? Now you have to plant and harvest. You can't just go eat all of the green plants, whatever you find. Now, there are people who think that's a great idea. Have you ever had dandelion soup or dandelion tea? Hung has. Okay, great. I never have, but I'm sure it tastes terrible. Probably tastes like grass clippings. I don't know. But you have to be careful with what plants you eat. Now you have to plant them, seed time, and harvest. It's not like it was before the flood. And now verse 4, he puts a comment in here. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. So there's a policy established with the giving of all animals. It has to be prepared properly. Now Bill Boggess, our missionary, called the other day, and he was asking about some other things, including the new covenant, and this subject came up of Acts 15. And I said, well, you know, Bill, I think Acts 15 is still is a regulation. It's a dietary regulation for the Gentiles in the church. It's never been rescinded by any apostolic legislation. Okay, so you can't drink blood, you can't eat the dead stuff by the side of the road, don't be involved with idolatry, and no sexual fornication. Those are the four things that the Jerusalem Council said, you Gentiles, you think idols are wonderful and immorality is the way to go, and you eat all kinds of dead things you find? Don't do that. And don't drink blood. We shouldn't do that. This is where that comes from. So when you eat an animal, it's got to be butchered and prepared properly. I grew up on a farm. That's not a big deal. It's a lot of work. There's a price you pay for that kind of thing, which is why a lot of people, if they go hunting, they'll pay somebody else to dress the animal out. But that's the prohibition. So animals will be terrified of you, and humans will eat them. Good reason to be afraid. And it's interesting to me, as I've traveled all over everywhere, how different our palates are when it comes to this, all animals are food. I remember teaching in Paris, and I was teaching in a Chinese seminary. Do you remember Tank Man from Tiananmen Square? He was one of my students. His name's Peter. And I got to interview him. He was left for dead. Guy that's in the National Geographic picture standing. He was the sergeant of arms. He is now a church planter in Europe. I'll tell you about it sometime. But I used an illustration I was teaching in the General Epistles. And I made an illustration about a dog. And the illustration didn't go anywhere. I mean, it was just, they didn't get it. So they'd assigned a handler to me to keep me out of trouble. So I look at her, trying to figure out, what in the world have I missed? Because it's, you know, it's not an American audience. And she looks at me like I'm an idiot. She says, "We eat dogs." Oh, that makes all. That's why it doesn't make sense. I remember when I was traveling through Spain, and I go into a meat market, and there's a dog hanging there, just like you go to the Chinese market, and there's a duck hanging there. So it's interesting to me that as you travel around the world, the pangolin, its name is food. But in our culture, in our worldview, you are abhorrent, it's abhorrent to you to think about this. That's how enculturated you are by the environment and the society in which you live. You are being convinced by the philosophers and the musicians and the educators that killing of animals for food is wrong. Do you understand that? You've been brainwashed. It's not wrong. It is good. And it's our culture and our enemy who's setting up the stage for the end times that's convinced you of the wrong doctrines. But it's just amazing to me how pervasive it is, even among my own students. Oh, Susie needs a special diet. She's a vegetarian. It's a personal choice she's made. Well, it's wrong. So we tell her it's wrong. We'd probably lose her out of the school, but it's wrong. It's not the right direction for the youth. So why can I say that? Well, because that's what Scripture says. So do I care about how you feel? No, I really don't. You have to make these choices, but I have to teach the Scriptures. And I'm telling you, God says all the animals are for food. Don't drink the blood. And the Spirit tells us you're in the time of the end where the cultural prevailing argument is you shouldn't eat your friends. You got low friends. But I was raised on a farm. Okay, we kept animals, but we didn't keep animals that were useless. It's a farm. I read an article. I got to hurry up. I'm wasting your time and mine. I read an article on Epoch Times, well-written article. It was a woman who was a renowned chef who started a vegan restaurant in California. And in the process of time, she found that she couldn't get the supplies that she wanted, so she started her own farming operation. She now became a farmer to supply the food for her restaurant. And within 3 or 4 years, she was now away completely from vegetarianism because she says it's unsustainable. You have to have the death of animals in order to provide for food. And she went through the whole thing. So it was just the sheer pragmatism of life that drove her away from her ideology. Not because she was converted. I could have converted her. No, I couldn't. But God converted her just from the sheer pragmatism of life. Because she starts talking, you have to have blood meal, and you have to put this and all the... If you're going to grow it, you have to have the death of animals. And what do you... And so she is no longer a vegetarian. Neither is a restaurant. All right, said way too much about it. Humans are going to be in animals, 3 and 4. And now in verses 5 and 6, we're dealing with the law of blood guiltiness. Surely for your lifeblood, I will demand a reckoning from the hand of every beast. Now, hand here in Hebrew, it's always used as the power of Yad Vashem, the hand of the name. It's the power. It's a figure of speech. Surely for your lifeblood, I will demand a reckoning from the hand of every beast. I will require it. So an animal that kills a human, what is the right thing to do with that animal? I'm asking.
Kill it.
You kill an animal. It's killed a human being. It must die. Years ago when I was a police chaplain, they sent me out to McKinney, and I did a debrief 3 days after an event with the firefighters. When I got there, their faces were white, their hands were white, they were clearly in post-traumatic stress. There were two of us in those days that had FBI certification on advanced dealings with critical incident stress, Ricky Hargrave, whom you know, myself. And he worked 911 in New York, anyway. And the call that they were sent to was a girl had been killed by pit bulls, and the grandmother had lost a leg. And they drove up on the scene, and the pit bulls were throwing the body of the little girl up in the air. They were on tow chains, and they worked the scene. They were first responders. And, you know, of all of the things that they had to go through in securing, getting the body, recovering the body, and securing the grandmother and all the intervention of all that, you know what they said was the worst thing that they had to experience? Was the family. The family said, well, we had the dogs before we had the children. So there's your worldview. That's your evolutionary, humanistic worldview. Humans and animals are on the same plane. But God sets that straight here. Whoever sheds by the beast, verse 5, I will require it. That animal has to die. And from the hand of man, and from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of the man. So, and here's the reason why. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for he is in the image of God. For in the image of God he made man. So in verse 6, he explains that humans, their lives, their blood is so precious that if their blood is shed unjustly, this does not include warfare, this does not include capital punishment, it actually is the argument for capital punishment. Human life is so precious that the only way you can atone for this law of blood guiltiness is by the death of the person or the death of the animal that caused the wrongful death of the human, the law of blood guiltiness. Also, as a police chaplain, I went to a conference in Portland, Oregon, and the only guy that was worth listening to was the rabbi, and he spent his whole hour and a half talking about the law of blood guiltiness and traced it through the Old Testament. And the basis of it is right here. Human life is precious because it is in the image of God. And all wrongful shedding of human life must result in the death of the person that did it, or the animal that did it. So why does God not need to destroy humans again? Well, there's several reasons that are given here. Life's going to be harder. The animals are going to fear you and try to kill you. You're going to eat them. and this law of blood guiltiness. No getting away with murder. We have that as a figure of speech. Oh man, that person got away with murder. No more of that. Cain, you killed your brother, you're going to die. Don't care what else, you're going to die. So that shortens the lifetime. So when you're all said with this, there will never be another global flood. And what he does in the next verses, 7 through 19, is talk about the promise, and I want to save that for next week. We'll go from the promise of God and how he makes it clear he's never going to do it again into Noah's debacle. So let's pray.